We've gotten to the end of Hebrews chapter 11, and I'm going to begin this morning by reading verses 35 through 40. So if you'll turn there and read along with me, Hebrews chapter 11, picking up with the second sentence of verse 35. We looked at the first sentence last week. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. In the book of Hebrews, there are three statements made that speak of impossibilities. In Hebrews chapter 6, 4 through 6, it says that if we turn away from the faith after we've once accepted it, that we can get to the point where it is impossible for us to be renewed to repentance. That's one of the terrible effects that sin has on people. It can put us past the point of no return. It never puts God past that point. He's always willing to take us back. But it can put us past the point of wanting to go back. In chapter 12, verse 14 of Hebrews, we're told to follow peace and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. It's impossible to meet God in heaven if we're not committed to living at peace with each other and to pursuing holiness in our life. And the third impossibility in Hebrews is in chapter 11, verse 6. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. And for some months now, we've been talking about the quality of faith and what it does for us and why we need it. We're going to finish up that discussion in chapter 11 this morning. There's going to be one other lesson, Lord willing, next Sunday on this subject of faith, because the first three, four verses of chapter 12 are the conclusion to chapter 11. And I don't know why in the world those who divided the Bible into chapters and verses thought it was smart to divide a conclusion from the argument. You don't do that. The argument always goes with the conclusion and vice versa. But next week we will look at the conclusion to Hebrews 11 from the first few verses of chapter 12. But there's a great contrast that the writer concludes with. The last individuals he mentions by name are found there in verse 32. There are four judges mentioned. Samuel, who was a prophet and priest, is mentioned. David, the king, is mentioned. And then there are some generalities that are given us. And the writer begins by talking about the conquest of faith. The victories of faith. By faith there were men who stopped the mouths of lions. Daniel comes to mind. By faith there were men who quenched the violence of fire. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come to mind. And by faith there were men who put to flight armies of the aliens, of unbelievers, and men like Gideon and Samson and Barak and Jephthah. They come to mind. And those are the great victories that the Old Testament tells us about people who live by faith. But that's only half the story. The other side of the coin is what I just read that speaks not of the conquest of faith, but of the conflicts of faith, of the problems that people encountered because they believed in God. And Christ does not promise us a rose garden. Sometimes becoming a believer makes our temporal life a lot harder, a lot tougher. And we're going to talk about the tough side of being a believer this morning as we conclude this. I'm going to divide our passage into two sections. verses 35 through 38, we're going to talk about the reality of faith. And then verse 39, 40, the rewards of faith. And so let's begin this morning by talking about the reality. And here's the reality. One quality we need in life if we are going to survive this life is the quality of patience. That is one of the most important characteristics, virtues that we can acquire. And our maturity, whether we've really grown up into the image of Christ or not, depends on our ability to take what life gives us. Now, sometimes, like Paul, we're knocked down. Paul says he'd been knocked down, but he was not knocked out. We started this study many months ago in chapter 10, verse 32 and verse 36, with the author noting the kinds of problems believers were facing then. Because they had put their faith in Christ, they were being persecuted. They were being persecuted by their former Jewish friends. They were being persecuted by the Roman authorities. And the writer says, what you need is endurance. Verse 36. You need to be able to tough it out, to hang on, to not throw in the towel, to not give up, if you're going to live life successfully. And so a lot of Hebrews 11 has been talking about how we acquire that trait of toughness, that trait of endurance. And to help look at that in a little more detail this morning, I want to turn just a couple of pages in my Bible to James chapter 1. In my Bible, I turn one page and I go from Hebrews 11 to James 1. And I want you to look at verses 2 through 4. James chapter 1, verse 2 through 4. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. And I think that's probably the best passage we could go to complement our studies here in Hebrews 11 and the passage especially that I read this morning. The writer wants us to know that we're going to have trouble in life. And trouble comes from one of two sources. There is the trouble that is described by the insurance companies as acts of God. And Christ, in Luke 13, talks about these two sources of trouble. An act of God is something that just occurs in the natural course of things. We live in a sin-cursed world. And when you live in a sin-cursed world, things go wrong. Nobody's to blame. It's just part of the price of living in a world that's been cursed by sin. And so in Luke 13, Christ talks about a tower that collapsed. Now, nobody put the tower up hoping it would fall on somebody, but sometimes buildings fall on people. Sometimes bridges fall down. They're not built, meaning for that to happen, but for various reasons they do. And Christ talks about a tower in Siloam that collapsed and killed a bunch of people. And trouble can come to us from living in this sin-cursed world. We may have a bridge fall out from under us. We may have a building fall on top of us. We may get some disease. We may get cancer. We may face various tragedies, accidents of life that happen because of the sin that is in this world. So trouble can come by acts of God. More troubling, I think, trouble can come not by a hurricane or a flood or a fire or a snowstorm or an avalanche. Trouble can come by acts of men. And the trouble that the Hebrews writer in this part of the book is thinking about in particular is that trouble that has come from sinful men. Christ in Luke 13 talked about the tower collapsing, and then he talked about Pilate sending soldiers in who butchered Samaritans while they were at church. While they were engaged in some kind of worship, the Roman procurator, Pilate, sent soldiers in and killed those people. And the reason that men are like that is because men can become filled with hate. And one of the worst things about hate is that hate hates love. That's the most egregious thing about hate. It hates love. And so somebody is hated by another person and the person's nasty to them and they think, well, I'll just act more loving toward them. And that will only make them hate you more if they are filled with hate. Hate doesn't need a reason to hate. In John 15:25, Christ says, they hated me without a cause. And he tells his men that if they hated me, they are going to hate you. So if you are a believer in Christ, expect trouble. Now, for most of my life, I've lived in a culture like you, which was not necessarily a menace to our faith. I've never been afraid of going to church for fear that the authorities or somebody is going to be lying in wait to arrest me when I get there. But that's all changing. Increasingly, you see things like this where authorities in this country are describing Christianity, our faith, as an extremist cult. I saw this headline the other day, blasphemous, that these so-called Christians, some of them in this country, are giving up Christianity for Lent. And in various ways, things we have taken for granted, things we have believed in, are now putting a target on us. Stand up for biblical morality, you'll be accused of being transphobic. Or guilty of some hate crime. Rahab lived in a city of hate. And for that reason, God passed judgment on the city of Jericho. So, in history, there are cycles we go through. Now, we were born, many of us born and raised in a cycle of morality and solid values. But that is all changing. And the ascendant religion is one that believes in this country now and in Western civilization is one that believes in beheading unbelievers. People who disagree with them. And so knowing this, we need to expect trouble. And James chapter 1 verses 2, 3, and 4 gives us three important reminders about trouble. And I want us to look at each one of them. And the first thing that James says in verse 2 is that the trouble that comes in life tests us. Our faith, our character is going to be tested by trouble. Faith is one of the foundations of our religion. And in Matthew 7, Christ said that trouble is going to test which foundation we're built on. It's very easy to deceive ourselves to think that we're building on the rock, which is Christ, when in fact we're building on sand. And so Christ talked about two men. They each put up a building, one on sand, one on rock. And what happened? A storm came and blew one of the houses away, the one that was built on sand, but not the one built on rock. And faith, trouble reveals to ourselves just where we are in our faith. Because it is easy to deceive ourselves, to think that we're stronger or more solid in our belief than we really are. And when we are lying to ourselves about our faith, our problems are always going to be with us. The only way we can get rid of problems from our past is by being realistic about our faith in the present. So long as we're not truthful with ourselves, telling ourselves we've dealt with the problem we've not dealt with, that problem's going to remain, and it's going to be very hard for us to have any hope in the future going forward. And trouble is an indicator that helps us see where we are. Trouble doesn't develop character as much as it reveals character. When trouble comes, we're wanting God to fix it. Our prayers, our aspirations at that time when trouble comes, we want God to fix it. But more often than not, God is trying to use that trouble to fix us. I was reminded of this yesterday. I told some of you at class, I got the call from friends down in Louisville that J.O. Smith died. J.O. was just 2 weeks short of 103. And when I began preaching 52 years ago down in Louisville, J.O. was, he and Geneva lived right around the corner from us, and he was an elder there in the church. Just a wonderful man, great man. 2 years younger than my dad. And so I'm going to go down and do his funeral Tuesday. And recently it seems I've gotten a number of calls and have talked to people about end-of-life kinds of things. And they're in end-of-life situations are troubling times. And just like we read from Ecclesiastes chapter 3, if you want to see where somebody is at in their character, in their heart, let somebody die. And if there's any evil in them, it'll come out. It may come out in such a way you think they're insane, you think they're mad, crazed. And so end-of-life situations are often good indicators of where we are in our development as a child of God. My neighbor behind me, Denise, she's 90. And I go over and talk with her. And I can tell you that she's scared. And I've read articles now that say hers is not an isolated situation. One of the greatest things the elderly fear is their family sticking them in some institution. Not because they're sick and needing medical care, but because the family doesn't want to be bothered with them. And Denise was telling me just this past week, she wants to go live with her daughter at Bales Lake. I said, why don't you? She says, because I've not been invited. And she says, I know they're wanting to stick me in some assisted living facility. And if they put her there, it's going to kill her. And often the reason, you know, it used to be people died at home, surrounded by family. They weren't stuck away out of sight for somebody else to take care of. And by being at home, guess what happened to the rest of the family that had to care for them? The family learned kindness and gentleness and selflessness and service. All of those qualities by caring for their loved one at home. And the trouble of dealing with the elderly often reveals where we are in our development as one who loves his neighbor and loves his family and loves his brother. And so there was Denise this past week, then Friday I got this call. First the husband, then the wife, not knowing each had called me, friends of mine down in Kentucky. And they were calling me about a brother-in-law. Godly man, a couple years younger than I don't think I've ever met him, but I've heard of him. Has had terrible health issues all of his life, but about a week ago he got feeling bad. And before, they finally took him into the doctor and he was diagnosed with a strep infection that had gone into his right arm. Tuesday, he had to have his right arm amputated. Then Friday morning, they were afraid the infection had gone to his left arm. And they're talking about amputating that. And what they called to tell me about, at least the wife, was that her sister, who's married to this man, they've had a tough marriage. It's been a tough marriage. Both of them headstrong, knocked heads over a lot of things in life. A lot of arguments. You know what I'm talking about. And my friends tell me about her sister. How is she going to react to this news of her husband losing one arm? His health's terrible. Now he's facing losing his other arm. Here's what her sister told her the other night when they were still not sure if they were going to have to take off both arms. Her sister said, "Listen, if they do that, I'll feed him, I'll clean him, I'll dress him, I'll undress him, I'll carry him wherever he needs to be taken, I'll do whatever it takes to care for him." She wouldn't have said that a few years ago. But she had grown to that point. And this terrible, now they didn't have to take off his arm, his second arm, but this terrible test has revealed her character at this point. Trouble is coming, and it comes because it's by trouble that patience is produced. That's the second point. Trouble tests us, and trouble produces patience. Somebody says, "I want patience. Lord, give me patience." You're asking for trouble, because that's how trouble is produced. Patience is not putting up with it, but you're mad all the time because you have to put up with it. Patience is not being fatalistic. You just give up. What's going to happen is going to happen. Patience is not denying that it hurts, like the Christian Scientists who try to deal with trouble by saying there is no such thing as trouble. There's no such thing as pain. Patience is none of those things. Patience is dealing with the trouble without losing your joy, without losing your hope, without losing your radiance in life. That's what Christian patience is. Anybody can be stoical. Anybody can be fatalistic. It's going to happen, whether I want it to or not, whether I pray or not, it's going to happen. No, patience is enduring without losing your loving outlook on life. And to get to that point, the third thing that James says is two things have to happen. Let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, lacking nothing. Patience has to grow and mature. And the two words that James uses, let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, those words perfect and entire are not synonyms. They are two very distinct words. The word entire means to be complete, to have all of your parts, all of the components of Christian character. And the word perfect means, once you've got all of the parts, to let those parts ripen. There comes a point in the growth of an apple where all of the parts of the apple are hanging there on the limb. Starts out with a flower, a blossom, a bud, but other parts are brought in and you end up with a stem and a hull and the apple meat and a core and the seed. All the parts are there in the apple, but it might be green. And if you ate it, it'd give you a stomach ache. You got to let for all the parts to ripen. And that's what trouble does for us in life. It gives us the ability to take what comes without losing our hopeful, joyful outlook on life. And if we'll let trouble do its job with us, we won't bail out. You know, a little smoke goes up, we're looking for the escape hatch. Let patience have its perfect work. Use the trouble to grow up so that we then are lacking nothing in regard to our character before God. That's the reality of faith. Don't be surprised when trouble comes. Understand what trouble can produce. It produces a quality you need to get through this life into heaven. And once trouble starts doing its job, stick with it to the finish, to where your patience is full grown. And then look at verse 39 and 40. We'll talk just briefly. I'll talk just briefly here about the reward. Does it pay to live by faith? And the answer in verse 39 and 40 is yes. Those who come to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. And verse 39 and 40 talk about the reward. Here's what they say again. Verse 39, and all these... All, everybody mentioned in chapter 11. The elders, starting with Abel and Enoch and Noah. And then the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then the lawgiver, Moses. And then the judge. And these people were not born with natural talent. You know, some people are born a natural athlete. Some people are born a music prodigy. None of these people were born super saints. They were born with all kinds of problems. Everyone in this auditorium right now can find your match in Hebrews chapter 11. You're somewhere in this chapter. But if they could live by faith, that means you can live by faith. And so all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith. You know who they got that good report from? Not from their fellow man, but from God. God looked at these people, found faith in them, and commended them. Gave them a pat on the back. Gave them an attaboy. Way to go. I love what you're doing. Men typically don't take note of the faith in other men. But God does. And all of these were people God looked at and smiled. And nodded His head and says, that's what I'm talking about. When I say the just shall live by faith. And then they obtained a good testimony even though they did not receive the promise. None of these people in Hebrews chapter 11 saw Christ in the flesh. Except for Moses, and that's on the Mount of Transfiguration. And he saw Christ in a glorified way there. These people were looking for a coming one, a coming Messiah. They didn't live to see that day. But verse 40 says, we did. God having provided something better for us. They lived before Christ, and the only way they saw Him back then was by a prophecy. A virgin shall conceive and bear a son. They saw Him by a symbol, a lamb being slaughtered, a lamb of the first year without spot or blemish, being slaughtered in the blood offer. That's how they saw Christ. But now we've got the book that tells all about Him. We can see Him just like we can see George Washington. Or Alexander the Great. I pulled down my copy of Plutarch last week and read his Life of Alexander. And man, I can see Alexander now because I can read about his life. And we can see Christ in a way they couldn't. We're in a better situation than they. But despite the fact we're in the better situation, they will be made perfect with us. When Christmas came around when I was a kid, I was usually up at 2 in the morning. Now, I wasn't allowed to go down and start unwrapping my presents at 2 in the morning. I had to wait for Mom and Dad to get up, and sometimes it seemed like they were never going to get up. We had to wait for everybody. And then when we're all up, then everybody got to open their presents. And so the Old Testament saints, they never saw the child born of the virgin. They never saw the child who would be called a Nazarene. They never saw the child healing every illness, working mighty wonders, raised from the dead. They just saw him in prophecy. We look back, we've seen the historical record. And yet we all are going to sit down around the tree at the same time and open our eternal presence. There is great reward in putting your faith in Jesus Christ, not only in the world to come, but right now. Paul says godliness has promise of all things, now and in the life to come. And if you want to be able to endure this life and be able to smile and laugh and enjoy it, rather than being beaten senseless by it, put your faith in Jesus Christ. And next week, when we go to chapter 12, we'll see how Jesus Christ exemplified everything that we've read about in chapter 11.